Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
All right, welcome. Dinty Child is a longtime member of the Boston music scene. Born Luther Moore Child III, he is a fearless multi-instrumentalist and one of five songwriters with the popular Rocky Roots folk band Session Americana. He's also a member of the Chandler Travis Philharmonic, of the Loud and Grimy Catbirds, and also fronts a 20-piece party band, the Funky White Honkies. After spending a lifetime in bands, Dinty has recently recorded his first solo album, Lucky Ones. We are honored to have him with us on Song Creating. Dinty Child, welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So how many instruments do you actually play?
Oh, God, I don't know. I really, you know, and play is a strong word. You know, it's like I can make sounds on a lot of instruments that are not offensive. Let's put it that way. You know, on a regular basis, I play guitar, accordion, mandocello, mandolin, hump organ, some violin, some bass. You know,
was one harder to learn than another?
Learn is a strong word as well. You know, I'm not somebody who I learn on the job. Really, people have given me instruments, or I've decided I should have something, and then I play in bands and I figure stuff out. And so that's it. You know, I do know that at this point, I mean, a mandocello is very similar to a mandolin in its the structure of its chords, but you're getting different chords because the strings are tuned differently. And I know that I think in mandocello rather than mandolin. If when I pick up a mandolin, I have to go way, you know, I just have to think about it a little more. So what I will say is that with all the instruments I play, it's really about the songs. You know, all I'm trying to do is make songs better. And so it's not about me taking solos or being some kind of virtuoso. I'm very happy to hang out for and not play for like three quarters of a song and then start bringing the pump organ in later on and just lift up the whole song. You know, what I have said before is what I like, and I've heard people have said, it's like, well, we saw the band, but you weren't there. I don't know. It's just better when you're there. And it's like, good. That means I'm doing my job. You don't necessarily know. Maybe, you know, if it's Session Americana, they miss the songs I sing, but it's the idea is that bands are better when I'm in them. But people don't really know why.
They used to say that about the guitar player in Count Basie's band who was never even plugged in.
Wow.
But there was something about having him there that they always seemed to like.
Sure, that rhythm is part of the thing. You know, it's just whatever it takes. It's a very interesting process. You know, like in Session Americana, I'm staring at the snare drum all the time. If I'm playing rhythm, especially guitar, mandolin, rhythmic things, I'm just playing with him. It's kind of the Keith Richards, Charlie Watts thing. Anybody else can be doing whatever they're doing, but I'm playing with that snare drum. And so, you know, it's just locking in, making an effort to lock in a way that makes the song better. That's all.
Yeah. And a lot of musicians will note that it isn't always what you hear, but what you don't hear.
Yep.
That certainly can make a song better. So let's go back to your childhood in the suburb of Boston called Sudbury. I think you may have gotten your start in a church basement. And I read your bio, man.
You read some stuff.
So were you writing music back then as a kid?
I had an older sister. I had four older sisters, and one of them played guitar. So there was a guitar kicking around that I started playing when I was probably 10. Or 11, probably 10 or 11. And there was a neighbor kid in the neighborhood who played, and his their parents bought them nice instruments and stuff. His brother played bass, he played guitar. And he and I somehow got together, and I had a really crappy acoustic guitar. I wanted an electric guitar, but my parents said, no, you have to like show that you can play an acoustic, you know, that you have to show us that you want to play. So I just had this like a finger bleeding action, high action acoustic guitar, but he had an electric guitar. And so we would get together and sort of fight over which of us got to play the electric guitar and which of us had to play the acoustic. But he and I probably wrote like about 100 songs together when we were like 11 or, you know, 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there.
Wow.
I still remember a couple, but most of them I don't. Most of them are lost to time. It was way before easily recording stuff. We sort of found a couple other guys and we started a band. So that was about when I was in sixth or seventh grade and somewhere in there.
I can't imagine how complicated these songs must have been at in sixth grade, but
Not complicated.
Who were you idolizing back then?
It was top 40 AM radio, Monkees, Beatles. But I mean, this, I'm talking like 65, 66, somewhere in there, 67. So, you know, Green Tambourine and whatever, yeah. You know, the first 45 I bought with my own money was Windy. Who's walking down. I loved that that sort of 60s pop that was on the AM radio a lot. I think it has stuck with me as a songwriter because I'm very much about choruses and melodies and choruses and things like that. So I remember like much later thinking like when U2 was around and thinking, you know, I bet there will be all kinds of music that come out of like people who never have heard, you know, 60s music and whatever and stuff. And I'm not nostalgic. It's like, I don't necessarily think one thing is better than another, but that's when you're a kid, that's the stuff that influences you, you know, now too. But I did have the four older sisters. So there was constantly stuff going on in the house. I mean, a lot of it was, musicals, you know, Kingston Trio, Joan Baez, stuff like that. But then again, the family stereo, the head of my bed and the family stereo one floor down shared a wall. And there was easily a year or two of my life where I went to bed every night with Louie Louie pounding through the walls from the living room below and my sisters listening and dancing and stuff. So all of that filtered in there for sure.
Yeah. So when did you start developing your songwriting into something a little bit more, mature, I guess might be the word.
You know, probably sometime in high school, I never wrote a lot. I still don't write a lot. But I think probably in high school at some point was where I wrote like a couple of songs that were a little deeper and maybe a little more trying to say something because for a long time it was sort of Hendrix and Cream and rock bands and, you know, playing the junior high school dances and all that kind of stuff. And then as one of my older sisters had a couple of friends who were very involved in the sort of trad, Greater Boston trad music, contra dancing, that kind of thing. And I got really into that stuff, the really folky stuff, the fiddle playing. I learned how to play fiddle and stuff. And then at one point I heard Bri Cooter, who was combining sort of folky stuff and electric stuff. I heard him and Fairport Convention the same day when I was 14, a friend played me those records, an older friend. And it was like a gut punch. It was like, oh, all right, I'm in on this. You know, it's like rocking, but I love the folky stuff. I love it all. You know, it's like, I would go back and listen to the scratchiest, craziest old fiddle records and whatever, you know, just really liked it all. But so somewhere in high school, I definitely wrote a couple of songs, and early years of college. But like I said, I've never written a whole lot. You know, it's come out in bits and pieces. That's why it's sort of ironic that it was 2020. It was pretty much exactly 2 years ago that I put out this record, which is my first record as under my own name.
Yeah. And are some of these songs from your distant past that are on the record?
One of them is pretty old. One of them, one called Tar and Canvas, is from college sometime. It's, you know, early 70s, because it was specifically about a friend of mine. Yeah, she's an instrument builder. I still play his instruments. And I don't know. I just was inspired to tell his story a bit, or just write a song for him. And it's a thing. It's a thing that I seem to do. It was interesting, you and I going back and forth about doing this podcast, was that I don't write about myself really much. There's very little that says I feel this way, or I'm thinking about this, or I'm doing that. But I've got a number of songs written for specific people. I seem to be drawn to telling a story that way somehow. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just not terribly introspective or something, but it all creeps in there somehow. But anyway, there were other songs before that, but they tended to be funny or, you know, lighthearted. When I consider couple of more serious ones, that was more when I was in college in the 70s. Yeah, I wrote a lot of stupid, funny songs earlier on, now that I think about it.
and you may still be with that border.
It's not far away. Yeah, that's for sure.
Right. So what is it that that prompts sparks your creativity in a song, if it's not something that happens to you? Do they tend to be story songs about people and about events, or are they sometimes just floral, you know, just going off about love?
I'll tell you what, I tend to, under a few different circumstances, and that is, I'll dream stuff, which is not a dependable way that I would recommend songwriting, because it only happens when it happens. But I have gotten to the point where I can be in a dream and recognize whether it's something I should wake up for or whether it's not. And I have a phone. My phone has all kinds of voice memos of me kind of going, you know, and just kind of, and I have to decipher those afterwards. And sometimes it's words and choruses, and sometimes it's a tune, but a lot of times there's a few words in there, like some kind of refrain or something. So my phone has a bunch of that stuff. And then, you know, I have a notebook where if something strikes me or I mishear something somebody said or whatever, I'll jot down a line. And I have a couple of pages of those. So what will happen? Oh, and so that's one thing, is that I kind of keep this stuff. And then I just don't tend to make the time to sit. I don't hardly ever say, okay, it's time to do some songwriting. I'd rather kind of clean my gutters and oil my basement than make time to write a song. But I do co-write a lot. In particular, I go on a songwriting retreat for a week every June with a group of friends. And that's where I tend to do most of my writing. And, you know, it's in any given year, it's maybe four songs or something, like three or four songs. And, you know, nowadays I know that is going to come up. We get a grant from Passim that has helped support this over the years. This will be our 13th year, I think. And And it's songwriters who are, you know, known, Chris Delmhorst and Mark Arelli and Rose Cousins, mm-hmm. and quite a few. There's, I think, 18 to 20 of us these days. So that's a place that I write. But it's almost always a co-write. And when I sit down with somebody to co-write, it's like, okay, what do you got? What do you got? And we'll listen to these things on my phone, or I'll say, well, here's this line in my book, or I'll read off a few lines that seem like they have potential. And somebody might go, oh yeah, that, hey, let's work on that. Let's see what we can do. And then you just start hammering it out. Or if I've got something on my phone, or it might even be a combination of them, we'll just start spinning something out from there. And then the other way that I have written is under duress, you know, under a deadline of some kind, where I took part in a songwriting workshop with vets with PTSD in September. And, you know, I had to write a song about this one guy's story. And, oh, it was brutal. It was hard to you have one day to come up with a song, basically. But I did it with Sean Staples' help, who's also one of those songwriters, and was taking part in this. So I had help, but it was like, so if I've got a deadline for some reason, or I'm at this thing, or that, you know, if it's just somebody who, like, there's a couple of people who we've sort of said, hey, let's get together and work on it.
So. Yeah. So when you come into this co-writing, is it usually with one other person or two or three?
I think it's pretty much always been one other person.
Okay. So are you really, does it tend to go 50-50? And is this somebody you must know well, I assume? It's got to be a relationship.
Well, that group of songwriters, I will often, you know, if I have a song, I think I wrote to you, I had this one song and it needed to be emotional and deep, and it really needed to be that way. And so then it's like, I've got Rose Cousins there and she's brilliant at that. And so it's like, I'll get her. Or there's something where it's a tricky structure. The words are a little hard to sort out or whatever. And there's a guy named Dave Godowski who just writes these, he's a brilliant wordsmith sort of. And so it's like, hey, Dave, maybe you can work on this song with me. And so like to use Mark Arelli as an example, because he, and I believe the song we're going to talk today about is one that I wrote with him, but, and we've written, I think 11 songs together at this point. You know, sometimes he's got most of a song and he needs a little help. He needs help with the last verse or two, or structuring the song. And sometimes I have most of a song and I go to him for some help. And then there are songs, like the one we're going to talk about, that are really just 50-50. I had the original idea, and then it's the two of us, you know, he gets a line, I get a couple of lines, I got to go to the bathroom and I come back and he's got a few lines, and you know, it's, mm-hmm. it can really go any way with any of these.
So do you tend to write lyric first or music first?
It really depends where the, like I say, if it's one of these dream songs, which is, I mean, is not an insignificant number of the songs that I write are part of them are from one of my dream things, sleeping things. But, you know, those tend to have both, or at least, like I say, like a line or two or something that I'm kind of working off of. And if Arelli and I pick a line out of my notebook, we'll just start bashing around some chords. Usually, you know, we'll just, it's just however it develops, however, you know, it's a funny thing. It's, I love it and I hate it at the same time. I really love it. And I love it having the finished thing, like that song I was talking about with the that I wrote for the vet. I came in the next morning and I said to this guy and his wife, it's like, all right, I wrote a song. Can I play it for you? And they're like, yeah, okay. And I played it. And by the end, they were just bawling. And they said, you told the story of our lives in that song. Mm. And it's like, geez, what a gift that is, you know? And I'll say that to my wife, where there's a couple of songs that I do. Like, I have a song called It's Not Texas that I wrote for a specific Session Americana does it. I wrote it for a specific person I know. And, who had lived a number of different places, but she was from Texas and I knew always missed it. And, we were in Italy one time and I was singing that song to an audience of probably 100 people that obviously didn't speak a lot of English. And there was one woman who sort of burst into tears in the middle of the room. And she just came up and hugged me at the break. And I said, you're from Texas, aren't you? She was like, yes. and the same thing. And it might even been that same tour, a bartender in England, a different song of mine called Dark Cloud, When the Dark Clouds Roll Away. She just kind of burst into tears. And, you know, it's like, I've just had things happen from songs that are really, really crazy. I had a dad tell me that one of my songs was keeping his son from committing suicide. And it's like, wow. That's heavy stuff. You know, it's like, I don't go into it thinking any of that. You just write a song.
Sure.
But boy, when you make that kind of connection in a deep way, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty awesome. And then you make people laugh and sing. I love that too.
And a Session Americana show has a little bit of everything too.
Yeah.
That's and true. I think it's When the Clouds Roll Away. Is that the song that you often end a show with? There's one of your songs. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Another, myself and Sean Staples. And again, we wrote it for a specific person really. And it was, you know, I had had a lot of that song. I think all the music I think is still mine. And then Sean helped with the words and yeah, it's a song that we would often, you know, just go out in the audience and sing it, acoustically out in whatever room or theater we were in and stuff. And yeah, it's same thing. I know a number of people who that song got them through some tough times. So,
yeah. Well, that's a real gift. So let's dig into this song a little bit,
sure.
Called Look Up. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, how this came about, what events sparked it and how you developed it.
Sure. So, at this place, we do this the songwriting retreat. It's a island in Lakeland, Passaic, New Hampshire, and it's a facility owned by the Appalachian Mountain Club, who have huts up in the White Mountains. I think this is their second oldest thing. It dates from, it's like a family camp, and it dates from 1900, and my family has over 100 years of associates. My grandfather started working there in summers in 1911 or something, and my parents met there. And, you know, it's just a long history. Anyway, long story short, I'm the off-season manager of the place, which basically means I monitor the comings and goings and the repairs and things that happen. And I have the keys, which means I can bring a group of songwriters there for a week and we can work on stuff. But I have, you know, responsibilities. I feel responsibilities when I'm there. And there was one year where early on, I can't remember. I was sweeping dirt off the big dock that we hang out on. I think it had rained and there was sand and dirt and I'm trying to get it clean. And I'm always feeling like things have to be in good shape. And someone walked by and was like, well, how you doing? And I was like, oh God, I'm doing okay. But I feel like the janitor in the Sistine Chapel. I just have to remember to stop and look up once in a while and just remember this beautiful spot I'm in. It's like, why we're here. Cause it's like anything. It's like you get going with your head down and you just forget what's around you. But we got to pay attention. So anyway, and I was like, that's kind of good. That's kind of a cool image. And it might've even been like the week after that was our songwriting thing. And Mark Arelli said to me, it's like, hey, I want some of that Dinty magic. I want to write a song together while we're here. And I know that he in his mind had something like my song Beer Town that Session Americana does, or, you know, like just a really fun audience sing along, get everybody involved, laughing. I think he wanted one of those because he writes like a lot of serious songs, and very folky serious songs. He wanted a more rock and up tempo song. And I said, great, I would love to do that. How about we write a song about the janitor of the Sistine Chapel called Look Up? And he was like, okay. And so we set a time, I think, for the next day. And we just started out, really. He was holding the guitar, so the most of the chords and music and stuff is from him. That's a thing I've found. It often helps if sort of one person is kind of playing. So the first verse, we just started, let's think about this guy. And this is, all right, let's set the scene. This guy, this janitor in the Sistine Chapel. And so the first verse is really just him talking about his job and stuff. And as part of this, we Wikipedia'd the Sistine Chapel because neither of us had been there. And it was pretty fascinating about a lot of it, about the ceiling is a progression of the Bible stories of like the fall of man from Adam and Eve. And going through. And so there's a line in at the end of the first verse, above my head, the fall of man, but it all depends on where you stand. Is he letting go or reaching out for Adam's hand? Because wherever you're standing in the Sistine Chapel, you're